please.
Yeah, well, you tell me if you're not hearing me properly.
We have to have two sets of everything in case one fails. This is the...
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
That's why the two microphones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought one is for singing and one was for speaking.
That's right. Yeah. And we'll call in the people down the hall in a little while and do a performance.
Yes, right.
Well, I don't know if we should say anything about ourselves, but I'm a historian of logging, and I've done those two books there. Set on Vancouver
good.
Island,
good.
Island timber, mountain timber. So I've made the big leap to the mainland.
From where were you living?
I was in the Cowichan Valley.
Oh, that's pretty.
Mm-hmm. And Victoria. I'm an island. I'm an islander.
And so you relocated to come to UBC? Is that
no, I. My other. I have a half-time job at BC Studies. I'm an editor.
Oh.
At the journal BC,
oh,
BC
that's
Studies.
That's a great journal.
Well,
that's really interesting.
Well, it is actually.
Is it printed on the side of the water?
It is now.
House? Yeah.
It used to be Morris and Victoria. Mm-hmm.
They were a good publishing firm. They mm-hmm. used to do the BC Library Quarterly, I remember. And,
yes.
You know, I was involved in a history of the UBC Library. It was a project for their 50th anniversary or something. And, we had it printed there. I thought it looked quite nice.
Dick Morris was the guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. His daughter is now running the press.
Mm-hmm.
So many East, but she's moved up to the Kootenays. I see her when I'm up there.
Which part?
She's at Winlaw.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's close to where I used to. I'm going to mention that on the tape because I came from Nelson.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Huh. That was my home base for all of my growing up years. So anyway, we'll go into that.
Yeah, again. Yeah. We should. Are we? We're live.
We are on tape. All the levels look good.
When I introduce myself, do you want the full name?
Oh, sure. Yes. Why don't you give us your full name? Because sometimes it's hard to find.
Okay.
Social insurance number, you know, date of birth.
That's right. Yeah, give me a bank statement. you ready then?
Well, we did.
You tell
sure.
me when I'm.
We,
yep, we're ready.
We do. We've given you the questions, some questions,
some
but
it.
But we could go. We don't have to have a
no.
structured, formal interview. We can go any. We can go anywhere.
There was one thing. That's,
so whatever your works best for you.
I was just curious what this really meant. Naturally, we want to avoid reducing the library to simply a means to an end. What? How?
I was thinking more not just of the library as a resource, but a library as part of the students' lives. So not
okay.
just strictly, well, we were able to provide these books for students, or we were able to do this, but
yes.
sort of how it fits in.
Okay. Bit of social history.
Social, yeah, exactly. That's sort of what I was looking
okay.
looking for when I
yeah.
sort of scribbled that down.
Okay, well, that was the only question I had about it. I may not follow whatever order you have here.
Oh, there,
just let it go
no,
where
just let it go
where it goes.
And I was thinking that a nice place to start might be, but I mean, I can start anywhere, but might be to talk about the 50th anniversary tape. CD that we watched
mm-hmm.
last week with John, and it was very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
So were you? You were obviously one of the instigators of that, or
no? I wasn't at all. I learned about it as they were developing the idea, and they asked whether, as the librarian, I'd like to have an input into it, and I said. Certainly, you know, I've been here a long time. I came in 66, so I'd had many years, had seen a lot of things happen in the law school. And John, of course, was a student, and so was Lynn, his wife. John was also a grade 7 student in my my wife's home room in Point Grey Junior High School. So we had that kind of connection, which was fun. One of my hobbies is writing songs, and it gave me a great opportunity to sort of contemplate what happened over the 50 years, starting with the veterans coming back, going through the hippie movement, the coming of computers, all that sort of thing. And of course, you remember from the disc itself that they didn't do them all at once. You had certain segments were the songs, and my clothing changed from time to time at the piano. And actually, it was fun to do. I had no hand in the editing of it, so I didn't know what it was going to look like until we actually had it in front of us. Amazingly, nearly all of it was done in one take, which is quite incredible for me, because I was both trying to remember the lyrics and writing, playing the appropriate score to go with them. So I was very pleased that it turned out well, and it was quite well received. They showed it at a banquet downtown at the law courts, I think it was. I can't remember now for sure where. But it was a good evening, because people from all those years ago were happy to come, and there were lots of laughs about the illusions that I alluded to. Although the interesting thing was, I was speaking in the song as if I was a member of a law class, which I was not. I had no legal training at all. And maybe I should start from that point.
Yes.
My full name is Thomas James Shorthouse, but everyone calls me Tom. I was born and raised in Nelson, B.C. My father was a butcher, had a butcher shop where I used to help out as a teenager. My mother was a homemaker. I have two brothers, one of them a lawyer, retired now. The other one a university administrator here, actually, at UBC. And a sister who followed me into the field of librarianship when her family had grown up and she was casting about for what to do with her spare time. She ended up actually working at the School of Librarianship as an admissions officer at a reference library and teacher. So we've had an interesting combination of both law and libraries within our own family, but never having worked together on any of that. I came to UBC after graduation from high school, and went into arts. My majors were English and history. And at the end of that four-year period, I decided to go into teaching and took the one-year, as it was then, education program. Started teaching in Surrey. I was there for 2 years in a high school, and I taught a variety of things, English and social studies, French, of all things, in the Woodward shop, actually, etc. And Surrey, of course, was very, at that time, very rural. It was largely pasture land, with a high school in the middle of a big field, and it wasn't very an entertaining way to spend your weekend. So I used to come into Vancouver all the time, to the bright lights and the activities here. And eventually I decided I really wanted to live in Vancouver, and I applied to the Vancouver School Board and was taken on and started teaching at Point Grey Junior High School in Kerrisdale. I was there for, I guess, 3 years probably. And in the second year I was there, I met my wife, and we were sort of both taught on the same staff at that point. Her name is Anne, and her field is the same as mine. From there, after our first child was born, I moved to Kitsilano High School and taught there for 4 years. And I taught the usual English, social studies, a little bit of French, and some math, because in those days, teachers had a much broader expectation that you might not always fit into the proper niche for which you were trained. And that wasn't bad. It was kind of made it more interesting in a way. But one thing that I did do there, which I really loved, was drama. I used to be very involved in theater, and in later years I did some film work and commercials and movies and so on, and that was a hobby of mine. And I thought, because in the middle 60s, all the junior colleges were opening up everywhere, and I thought, you know, it would be a good idea to have maybe something I could use in school, which was not necessarily English and history, which would be the logical things for me to do my master's in. The library school had opened at UBC a couple of years before I decided to apply to go there, because I thought that'll be an interesting thing I could do. I could do a coursework in the high school, but also do drama. And libraries would be something which would be a very flexible sort of thing I could be doing. So I took the course. I liked it a lot. I worked quite hard at it and went back to the school board and said, you know, I'm ready to go into the library. What have you got? And they didn't have anything open at all. But the junior colleges were sprouting up everywhere. UBC was expanding. And
when, can I just ask when this was?
1964, 65 is when, right, I came to UBC.
So you've been teaching them for
10 years.
10 years.
Right. Yeah. So I applied to the library school, and as I say, liked it, and couldn't get a job at the school board. But UBC and New York Public Library and libraries all over North America were recruiting, so I wasn't worried about not getting a job, but I didn't really want to move my family away from Vancouver particularly. So when UBC came up with something, which happened to be in the Faculty of Education, I took it. At that time, I didn't have an education library. It was a what they call a curriculum laboratory. It was a teaching materials library for students who were going out on practicums and so on, and to use the library for coursework, etc. Since then, it's become an education library. But I was only there for 6 months when I was asked by the UBC library administration to consider the law library, because there was going to be an opening there. And my first thought was, well, I don't know anything about the law. I think I'd be all at sea, but I'll go and have a look. So I went over to the library and walked around, and I didn't like it. I hated it. It smelled bad. I mean, for one thing, they had so many old sets of leather-bound volumes which were deteriorating through lack of proper care and overuse, I guess.
Was this in the old...
This was in the building built in 1952.
So the predecessor to the fortress.
Right. That's right. And actually, it was really, even in 1952, was considered to be the first stage of what would be a permanent law building. So, but anyway, I looked it over and thought, I just don't know. I don't know. Two members of the faculty said, why don't you come and talk to us, and we'll tell you what we're looking for, and maybe it'll brighten up your view of what we can offer in the way of a library work. Up until 1964, it had been the Faculty of Law Library administered by the faculty. In 1964, it was taken over for administrative reasons that the faculty was quite happy to admit by the main library, and to be controlled by the main library, and the staffing would be going through the main library, human resources people and all that. So it would have been working in the law faculty, but administered by the library. But anyway, Leon Goetz and Ray Herbert asked me to go to lunch at the faculty club, and the interview was interesting because we didn't talk about anything except my personal life and what my interests were. And I right off the top said, you know, I don't bring any expertise to the law here. I think I know how to manage a collection, making it accessible to people, building it, possibly, but I don't know anything about the subject. I would have to have a quick learning phase here. If you want me to come, that's what you might be prepared to get. And they were very nice. Both of them were delightful. And Ray Herbert was actually, I think he was in the first law class after World War One, World War II, who had taught labor law. And so I told the May Library, yes, I would be happy to apply for it, because there didn't seem to be anybody else applying. I think people looked at it and thought, there's just too much work here. I mean, we got to start from scratch, which is really true, because in 1964, Doreen Ingram, who had succeeded Diana Priestley, and Diana was a legend. She was a graduate of the Faculty of Law in the days when women were very few in number. She had a sparkling personality, a great wit. She also had a law degree, naturally, and took a library degree at University of Washington, and was a real catch for George Curtis. He hired her immediately, and she ran the library for several years. And when she retired, then Doreen was sort of an interim librarian in 1965 for a couple of years there. So when I spoke to her as well, because I wanted to know what she could advise me about the planning of the library, and I just found this today, some papers here that describe what I would find in 1966 in the library situation. It's really quite...
Could we photocopy those?
You can. Yes, certainly. I'd be quite happy to give them to you.
Excellent.
One thing that was really interesting, I thought, when I was finally in place, was that for the last year or two, they had started constructing a catalog. I wish I could show you a picture of the building so that you'll know what I'm talking about, but the building itself was not an unattractive building. It was a one-story affair with great windows overlooking the ocean. As you entered through the vestibule, straight on from you, you could walk across the vestibule to an open door which led into the main reading room, which George Curtis always was so proud of, because it was such a gorgeous room in the sense that you had such a wonderful, spectacular view. That was the main reading room, and it had all the law reports from all the Commonwealth law reports. So that would be England, Scotland, Canada, etc. Mm-hmm. To the west of that was another room. And these were all individual rooms. You had to go through a hallway to get to them. Was what we call the journals collection. That was West, Law West. That's where all the journals and serials were kept. And then Law East, which was across the other hall, was the American room. And closer to the front door, on each side of the door, there were the dean's office, which is the far end of the corridor, and two faculty offices. On the right-hand side were two offices, one of which would be mine, the other one would be the reference librarian, and there was Law South, and Law South was the only teaching room in the Faculty of Law in the law building at that point, because all the classes were being held in army huts that surrounded this new structure. So it was a dissected sort of campus for the Faculty of Law. You walked across gravel walkways and so on to get to class, and you walked back to get into the library. And it was a wide open library and so on. So that made management a bit difficult. I realized immediately there was practically no control there. We needed to do something with the collections. We managed to get Law South vacated by the faculty, and their classes would be held somewhere else. And that room was used for the monograph collection and for circulation of reserve materials. Okay, and that could be locked. All the faculty had keys to the library, unlike anywhere else on campus. It was the only library I know of in which the faculty had 24-hour access to the whole place. So we counted on them to be very thoughtful about making sure they signed out what they took. Initially, it was all done by hand, of course. And the students could use the library on the weekends, but only certain parts would be open to them. It worked very well, but we outgrew it terribly quickly. My own staff, which at that time consisted of six people, did all the acquisitions of materials, circulation of them, reference work, and so on, in the open corridor. That's where their office was, in the open corridor. And beyond that was a little room where we kept all the stuff that was to be bound. It was really very hodgepodge and difficult to manage easily. The 60s were a time, of course, of much student activity. I remember the weekend when the students, Jerry Rubin and his pet pig took over the faculty club. It was the Vietnam War era. So we could always count on lots of activity that spilled from the campus into the law building. We would often have protest rallies, sometimes street theater of various kinds. And it became so loose that we occasionally had soccer matches right in the front hall. It was fun, but always a little worrisome because you weren't sure where it was going to go. So for my staff health and morale, we had to insist that we do some enclosing of the area so that they could work in, relative comfort. And that meant that this lovely vestibule leading into the grand room had to be closed off. So the building lost a lot of its cachet at that point, but it was necessary in order to maintain services.
Yeah.
Okay. So that took us up to, that was about 1973, around 1973 we did this. By this time we had two reference librarians because the students were large in number. The faculty had increased in size. And so many new things were happening. There were the standard courses that were always taught in law school, but suddenly we had environmental law, we had family law, we had all kinds of socially implicated fields, such as prison law, and not necessarily prison law, but that part of society was explored at depth there. Criminal law was a separate subject at the time. And so my collection responsibilities beyond contracts and name the fields, real property, whatever, expanded quite a bit. And I had to be quite aware of what publications were coming out from the various law publishers. Sometimes, not law publishers always, but usually.
How did you decide on a policy of what to order? Did the faculty let you know, or did you have to keep on top of?
We had a faculty library committee, which rarely met. Only when there was an occasion of some concern, which fortunately there weren't many. Sometimes I would acquire things which I, in retrospect, I thought, it's really better placed in the main library than here, but they didn't seem to have it, so I acquired it. librarians' mistakes are always for the world to see later, of course. You happen to get that on the shelf. But that didn't happen too often. The newspapers, the magazines, the movies were filled with legal issues. Everything happening seemed to have a legal aspect to it. So I made a point of making sure that we acquired all the Canadian law publications that were substantial, and that was most of them. That'd be from Carswell and Butterworth, and we got a lot of loose leaf services from CCH and Butterworth and Dubu, for example. West Publications, and eventually, because there was an impetus to broaden our scope to include American law, excuse me, we acquired all the state codes and basically all the major West publications of law reports and so on, and the digests that supported them. So there is, in terms of law schools starting to expand in enormous ways, there was also a huge output of new publications that were coming out. And so a large part of my life was spent in choosing materials and finding the budgets adequate to acquire them. That became increasingly difficult because every law school suddenly had its own law review. Now, you had to decide, were we going to be omnivorous and take all the law reviews, which I thought we should, because the index, the legal periodicals, and like publications always cited them. So the cost of running the law library from the point of view of collections really did go up. And I must say that I was supported well by the main library. Occasionally we had to put things on the back burner, but for the most part we did pretty well with that. One thing I know, because I didn't know anything about law, I didn't know about citation very much, and so we had to make citation of documentation in law readily apparent to students and faculty. So I created things that eventually, I'm sure, went into the garbage heap, you know, as the years went by. I did an enormous file of abbreviations used in law. We had drawers of them, so that if you found a citation you didn't understand, hopefully we had unearthed it and included it in our file. But that was a good project, and part of my thing, knowing that I didn't know much, was to make it as simple as possible for people. Lots of shortcuts. We created a serial list of all the titles that we had in the library, and that was an interfiling of law reports, journals, newspapers, if there were any, general magazines, and so on. And we interfiled them alphabetically and hung them on stacks around the room. And that was a guide to you. If you didn't know, where is the Harvard Law Review? All they had to know was it was in the journals area, and here's the call number for the Harvard Law Review. And that it made kind of a cluttered look about building, but it was a very useful thing, and that was one little thing we did that was great.
Were the abbreviations on file cards?
Yeah.
Have those survived, I wonder?
I'm just thinking they're dumped, but I don't know. I don't know. But I should get back to the catalog, because it's interesting. The one thing I did discover early on was that during that period, just before I came, they had started reconstructing the card catalog, which was the key to what your library contained. For many years, the main library cataloged the material for law, but law didn't use the cards. As far as I know, they threw them away because there was a feeling that people weren't going to go to the card catalog. If they were lawyers, they didn't use card catalogs. They found other ways of finding things. And so we had to reconstruct a catalog to start with. And so the main library took all its records and provided and produced card sets, which we've had to file. And, you know, this was a boring part of library work, because once a week the whole staff would drop everything and sit and file cards in alphabetic order above a rod that was in the drawer.
You mean these were new new citations that have to be
But they were just new cards. They might be an old book, an 1898 treatise on the law that you happen to have. But that set of cards would have a main entry card, which would be author if there was an author, a title card, maybe several subject cards, that's possible, a series card, and so those would have to be filed. Now, the series cards all were in one section, the author title, the subjects were in one session, the author and title series cards were in another.
So every new acquisition had to be...
That's right.
...taken apart.
It had to be taken apart and filed. And they sat above the rod until a revisor came over from the main library, checked your filing, and then pulled the thing out and dropped the cards. I mean, this is really primitive by today's standards, mm-hmm. isn't it? But it was the only way we could do it. And so we created a card catalog of all the retrospective things we had owned and all the current ones that we were acquiring. And it worked well, except none of the books had call numbers on them, which meant that all your monographs were filed by author. Now, that was okay if the author was voluminous and he wrote all in the same field all the time. But it would mixed up people who wrote it across various subjects, put all of the books together in one clump. In other words, there was no classification scheme whereby your criminal law books were together, your contract books were together, et cetera, et cetera. So all law libraries in North America were fussing about what classification scheme we should use. We had a catalog, but no classification yet. The Library of Congress, which is the classification service we use, was just working on the American law one, which was KF. KF was the first published. And some law schools chose KF and used that as the guide to force books on the subjects that were part of KF into that particular thing. I liked a particular one which was developed in the United Kingdom by Elizabeth Moyes, and it was went from KA to KZ subjects through all jurisdictions. That seems simpler to me than at this point trying to force things into the American thing, in the American scheme. So we chose that one. And coincidentally, the Courthouse Library chose it as well. They took our lead, and their library, I think, is still filed that way. But what it meant was, once you'd chosen a classification thing, you had to do your whole catalog all over again. So what we had already put together once had to be done again, but with call numbers on them. And the books all had to have call numbers put on them. So you can imagine the work that was involved in that. It was an amazing thing. And once we got all the call numbers on them, then we reshelved them all. We'd left them in their author listings to start with. Once the call numbers were on, all of them, we reshelved the whole thing into a call number sequence, which is the way it lasted until you moved into the new building now, because now LC has done Canadian law, British law, Irish law, German law in their own schedules now, so that in the law school library in 2012, you have collections that are arranged by classification jurisdiction. They're jurisdictional, which makes very good sense. The only thing it lacks is the possibility of knowing if the contract law is such a way in Canada, how is it in the United States? They're going to be separated so that all your contracts books are not together. It's contracts Canada, contracts United States, contracts Great Britain, whatever. It's just a different way of doing it. That wasn't available to us. The Library of Congress didn't have that, hadn't provided that availability back in the 70s, which is when all this happened.
And I was going to ask about the staff. You said you had six staff. Are there any notable ones who you want to mention, or were they full time?
Yes, they were. there was a lady, Molly Buckingham, who was she was in her 60s when I came. Excuse me. And she mothered the students a lot. I think she probably took home a darning for them. I don't even know, but I know that they went to her with their problems, and she was a very calming influence. And as a matter of fact, I once discovered that she was selling sandwiches in the circulation division that she had made at home, because the kids would turn up, and they were mostly all men who were batching, of course, and didn't bother bringing a lunch, were grateful to buy from Molly. The university wasn't too pleased about this. They didn't want a lawsuit in their hands for tainted food or something, so we had to stop that. This reminds me, too, that one other thing that was very common about law was that it was so male-based. There were very few women. And I used to sit in my office and look across the way. There was a student lounge. And the few women that were there would stand outside, and a friend would go in and get them a cup of coffee, because they were just clearly not welcome in the student lounge, you know. And it's really quite shocking, really. So much so that at one point the women rebelled. I can't remember when this happened. It would be in the 70s sometime. And they took over the men's washroom for as many days as they could, just to make a point, because, of course, the building had been built largely for men, and there wasn't adequate facilities for women, et cetera, et cetera. But the whole notion of women in any numbers going into law was almost heretical, I think, but not today, of course. I think women outnumber the men in law schools. If it isn't even, it's, you know, it's that way. How'd I get onto that? Mm. Oh, I was talking about Molly Buckingham.
Yes. Yeah.
we had colorful people. Alan Soroka, who retired from Faculty of Law just a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, came to us from New York City. He was in the pro bono field of law, working with indigent people and people who couldn't afford to have lawyers and so on. And he brought lots of great stories with him. The students loved him because he was very colorful. He was very controversial in lots of ways. He had very left-leaning views, and they got him into some trouble at certain times of his career. But he was always well-meaning in the library. I enjoyed his company and encouraged him as much as I could to do the kind of things he did best, and that was teaching students how to use the materials.
Was he part of the draft dodger crowd or the war resisters?
No, he came, but it coincided with the same thing. He came about during that period. We had one student who always brought his black Labrador dog to class, and excuse me. And that raised a few eyebrows, because some of the teachers were a little adamant about because they had come from the days when lawyers wore gowns and not wigs, but dressed appropriately, and that these guys would come in with bare feet and dogs. And we had one guy, he used to come in with a crow on his shoulder. He had a pet crow of some sort and a bowler hat. And, well, it was a very colorful time. When we actually moved into the bunker, it became much more professional. For its many faults, it functioned not too badly as it made sense. It just wasn't very inviting.
Just going to pause this for one sec.
We need to, because my voice